The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 24th of October 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Emma Nelson, and coming up this hour, with Rishi Sunak almost certain to be crowned the UK's new Prime Minister, we'll ask what it means for the country and its relationship with the international community, in particular Europe. Also ahead, Hillary Clinton's former advisor considers the prospects of the Democratic Party as the United States prepares to contest crucial midterm elections.
You know, you have a media environment in which the Republicans, conservatives have huge channels to spread disinformation and to disperse lies about what's happening in this country. And I think that creates a real challenge for any democracy.
We'll have an update from Australia as the country's Labour Party delivers its first budget in a decade. And then we'll have a quick fire roundup of news from Slovenia, Croatia and Montenegro.
I'm Guy Delaunay, Monocle's man in the Balkans, and I'll be telling you how Melania Trump's lawyer could be Slovenia's next president, and how a cozy coffee in Croatia could cost you.
That's all coming up right here on The Briefing with me, Emma Nelson. So, unless there is a major upset, and frankly, here in London, we're becoming quite accustomed to them, Britain's next Prime Minister could be decided in the next 2 hours. Rishi Sunak, the former Chancellor and the man beaten to the Conservative leadership race this summer by Liz Truss, stands to inherit the doors to No. 10 Downing Street. Mr. Sunak was, and still is, a Brexiteer. But a warning came this morning from one of the UK's leading investment chiefs that the UK may need a bailout for the International Monetary Fund and is now heading on the way to being the sick man of Europe, and that Brexit needs to be renegotiated. Well, Quentin Peel is an Associate Fellow of the Europe Programme at Chatham House, and I'm delighted to say he joins me in the studio. Welcome back, Quentin.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you with us. Now, Mr. Sunak was a Brexiteer, is a Brexiteer, and part of his campaign was to vow to put EU-based UK legislation through the shredder. What else do we know about him and his position to Europe?
He's been pretty cautious, really, in spelling out his position on the, if you like, on the immediate problems, like the Northern Ireland Protocol, on which Liz Truss had a very hard-line position, and she wanted effectively to either get rid of it or rip it up, which would have almost inevitably brought us into a trade war with our most important trading partner, the European Union. Now, I think, but I stand ready to be corrected, that Rishi Sunak is fundamentally too sensible on the economic front to want a trade war at this stage. He knows what a desperate state the British economy is in, and he knows that the key to him surviving as Prime Minister and having any hope at all of winning an election in a couple of years' time is getting the economy right. That means don't go to war with Europe.
That doesn't necessarily chime with the fact that the number of high-profile, hardline Brexiteers came out in support of him in the last few days. People who had ordinarily, or in the past, had backed Boris Johnson. He's now out of the picture. But you have the likes of Lord David Frost, whose incredibly aggressive stance towards Brexit, towards the European Union, got everybody into an awful lot of trouble and bother. There are hardline figures who are now saying that Rishi Sunak is the man. Is that because they know that they're backing the winning horse, or is that because they probably believe that Sunak could follow their lead?
I think it's more the former than the latter. They're jumping onto the bandwagon that's clearly running, and they were actually coming out against Boris Johnson coming back. If Boris Johnson had come back, I think the markets would have gone berserk, and I think that actually voters would have also been very angry at the man who had really treated the office of Prime Minister as a joke, was being brought back. So I think that those Brexiteers lining up to support Rishi Sunak, it's an ominous sign, but it's not yet a terminal sign. I think Rishi Sunak is sensible enough to want to sit down and do what he was told he should do today, renegotiate the terms of Brexit so we've got a more sensible deal. Not reverse, but renegotiate.
You've mentioned this warning about renegotiating the Brexit agreement. That was the voice of Guy Hans, who's the founder of the private equity firm Terra Firma, who's come out with some devastating comments about the British economy at the moment. He said that the UK is becoming the sick man of Europe, and unless Brexit is renegotiated, the economy is doomed.
This is a man who's put a lot of money into the Conservative Party over the years. And what he was saying as well was the problem is that the Conservative Party is at war with itself. So that's the very first thing that Rishi Sunak has got to do, has got to try and reunite the party. That's going to be a huge challenge. I mean, the truth is that nobody wants to be Prime Minister in their right minds at the moment. The economy is a complete mess. The country is deeply divided, above all on the Brexit issue, and there's a war in Ukraine which is sending prices sky high, the highest inflation we've had for 40 years. So it's going to be a really tough time and a big challenge. And if Rishi Sunak is stupid enough to seek out confrontation with our European partners, that would really undermine everything that he would hope to gain by being Prime Minister.
It's not just the United Kingdom which is divided because of Brexit, it is the Conservative Party itself, in a sort of almost irreconcilable way, that arguably those who were the strongest Brexit voices, well, there has yet to be a positive argument for Brexit. And many of the papers recognise this. And even the pro-Brexit newspapers are saying, actually, the fact that the party is so divided means that no success can ever come of Brexit, because there will always be those who say, you know, it was a disaster. So when we say we need to renegotiate the Brexit agreement, what do we need to do? Rejoin the single market? Or what would be the answer?
We need to renegotiate terms which do give us much better access to the single market, and in some way possibly or also in the customs union. Now, none of that's going to be easy because, one, the European Union member states are not happy to just give us our cake and let us eat it. They are really annoyed at the way we've behaved up till now. So there's an awful lot of improvement of the British negotiating position that needs doing by the next Prime Minister. So having said that, I think let's look for a moment at what Guy Hans was really also arguing, because he said, look, pro-Brexiteers had always argued we'd have a low tax, low regulation economy, and that would be a triumph, a sort of pure Thatcherite economy outside the European Union. Well, that has failed. Liz Truss showed that was neither what the markets were prepared to stomach, nor actually the general population. So we need to do a better Brexit.
How do you think that Rishi Sunak will be received in Europe? Not necessarily as the leader of a very, very troubled country, a very, very troubled party, but in terms of his personal figure, a man who many people have said doesn't necessarily appeal to the average voter. He talks about sort of posh Coca-Cola and having seven types of bread in his house. But he might be someone who appeals to, let's say, the likes of Emmanuel Macron.
Yes, I don't know. We haven't actually seen him exposed on that European stage very much. He is an extremely rich man. He's an extremely rich man who actually kept his green card to work in America. He knows America very well. He's got a house in California, I believe, and spends a lot of time there. So he's not really a switched on European. He doesn't perhaps understand Europe as well as he might. I would hope that would be a first high priority, because it's not just the trade with Europe, it's of course getting peace in Ukraine, and that's going to be a very high priority.
So we could see a Sunak prime ministership looking much more towards the United States than towards Europe.
I think that's a danger, but I think the priority should be getting things right on this side of the Atlantic, because that's where relations have been very badly damaged.
Quentin Peel, thank you so much for joining us. The time here in London is 12:09. A quick look now at the latest headlines. Here's Monocle 24's Marcus Hippie.
Thanks very much, Emma. Ukraine has said Russia could be preparing to escalate the war by using conventional explosives laced with radioactive material. Moscow has also accused Kyiv of preparing to use a dirty bomb, but this claim has been dismissed by Western officials. A Brazilian politician has been taken into custody after throwing grenades at police officers who came to arrest him. Roberto Jefferson, an ally of the far-right president Jair Bolsonaro, wounded two officers before surrendering to police in Rio de Janeiro state. And Saudi Arabia has confirmed that it is in advanced negotiations to order dozens of A350 jets from European aviation giant Airbus. Analysts say the move is part of a strategic effort to launch a new airline and challenge traditional carriers in the Gulf. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Emma.
Thank you very much indeed, Marcus. Now, US Republicans have narrowed a number of state elections with just over 2 weeks to go until the congressional midterms. Monocle's Washington correspondent Chris Chermak has been hearing from Navin Nayak, a former head of opinion research for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign and now president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. They began by discussing the hurdles that a US president's party faces historically in midterm elections.
The reality, as you said, is right, which is midterm elections historically for almost 100 years now in this country have been pretty unforgiving to the president's party, and especially unforgiving when the president's party also controls Congress. And in that respect, two things are pretty astounding right now. The first is that the outcome, particularly in the Senate, is very much in doubt, despite the fact that it's a 50-50 Senate. I mean, Republicans only need to net one seat, and there's a genuine doubt whether they could even do that. So I think that's the first thing that I think is a real indictment of the Republican Party and sort of the extremism that's coursing through them. And I think that's the second point I would make, which is the reason to think that this midterm could be different is that right now it is positioned to be much more of a choice election between, you know, Joe Biden and Democrats and sort of MAGA extremists on the other side. And the extremism of the Republican Party has not only been put on the ballot in a way that it isn't historically in a midterm election, but I think it's a reason why we are likely to see maybe the highest midterm turnout in our nation's history. That is not a good sign for Republicans. Now, the control of Congress is so close that it's a pretty steep challenge for Democrats to hold on to both the Senate and the House. But I feel a lot better about those odds if turnout is really high.
Well, you mentioned the extremism of the Republicans there. I do wonder to what extent this election is being driven by negatives about the Republicans and to what extent it is being driven by positives and excitement for the Democrats and their agenda.
Welcome to American politics. The truth of the matter is, for decades now, this notion of negative partisanship drives our politics. Neither party feels particularly enthusiastic about their own party at any given time, but they increasingly dislike the other party. And that's the reason why we have the kinds of midterms we usually have. When one party is in power, the other side is very animated and very energized. And typically, and certainly in the last 20 plus years, that has led to wave midterm elections on both sides. What's unique and potentially historic about this midterm is that the Democratic side might be very energized as well. And, you know, there's no reason to think that will be about Democratic accomplishments, unfortunately, although I think the fact that Democrats have accomplished a historic level, historic number of things by any measure, make people feel a lot better about the Democratic Party. But make no mistake about it, that the threat that MAGA Republicans pose and the sort of fundamental freedoms and rights they would take away are absolutely going to be more animating.
On issues specifically, I wonder, what are the primary issues driving Democratic voters to the polls?
I think it's impossible to think that it isn't abortion as a huge driver. In my lifetime, we haven't seen a fundamental right stripped away in this sort of callous, wet fashion. But that is a very real consequence for millions of women in this country. That being said, I actually think that the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the stripping away of the right to an abortion just crystallizes the broader extremism in the Republican Party. I don't want to discount that, you know, we are less than 2 years removed from a horrific attack on our Capitol, trying to overturn a free and fair election. You know, that topic has been brought back into the forefront of the national conversation with the January 6th hearings. Obviously, the economy continues to be top of mind, and I think Democrats have work to do in reminding the American people that they're the only party that's actually tried to do something to lower people's prices, whether it's prescription drugs at the gas pump or energy more broadly. And, you know, Kevin McCarthy and MAGA Republicans are offering the exact same agenda that the former Liz Truss government put forward that involved cutting taxes for the wealthiest Americans and for corporations, that sent markets and the British economy into a tailspin. And I think we've got to remind the American people that that's what they are offering if they get into power as well.
So I do have to ask you, I mean, this race is still extremely close. There's a good chance that the Republicans could take the House and maybe even the Senate. What does that say about the Democrats? Will there have to be considerations after this election about how to more effectively get their message out in future?
That's a great question in the sense that it assumes that we live in an asymmetric world or a pure world, and we don't. You know, you have a media environment in which the Republicans, conservatives have huge channels to spread disinformation and to disperse lies about what's happening in this country. And I think that creates a real challenge for any democracy. I don't think it's a failure of capital D Democrats. I think it is a challenge to small d democracy in this country when we don't actually have a common truth. And I think, you know, you compound that with the fact that we do have an inflation problem globally that the U.S. is also affected by. And again, I think it would be a significant victory. And I mentioned this earlier. The fact that this election is even close, even mildly reasonable Republican Party today would be running away with this midterm election.
And just finally, what particular races are you going to be watching on the 8th of November that will tell you if this has been a good night for Democrats?
I think, again, from my perspective, keeping this close is a huge victory. I know that that might sound like a moral victory, but it's not in the polarized environment of U.S. politics today. And so, you know, starting with Senate races, I think if, you know, Democrats win in Pennsylvania, if John Fetterman wins the Senate race in Pennsylvania, that is a huge deal. It's a pickup. It's a seat that's held by Republicans. It's a seat that in a better year, Joe Biden only narrowly won a state like Pennsylvania. And I think Georgia is another example. I think it'll be a very good night for Democrats if Mandela Barnes is also winning in Wisconsin. That to me suggests that it is likely to be a very good night overall, given that you have an incumbent Republican who would be defeated.
That was Navin Naik there in conversation with Monocle's Washington correspondent Chris Chermak. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
The Foreign Desk is Monocle 24's weekly global affairs programme. We tackle the world's biggest news stories, as well as those left untold.
If actually you speak to the ordinary people, their aspirations is for a unified country, whether you talk to business people, to school teachers, to market traders, and so on and so forth, across the board, is they want to see their country recreated as it was, only this time as a democratic, accountable system.
Our expert guests offer in-depth analysis and first-hand experience.
One of the Ebola treatment centres I went to had been burned down by a community that were very resentful and frightened of Ebola, and they still have a bunker in the middle. They've dug a big, deep bunker where they can hide if people come and shoot at them.
The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller, is available every Saturday from midday London time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Now, the first budget under the administration of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese will be handed down in Australia tomorrow. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, says it will be a solid, simple and sensible blueprint for the times. It's being published against a backdrop of familiar economic challenges, the cost of living and a slowdown in economic growth. Well, Karen Middleton is the Saturday Paper's chief political correspondent in Canberra. Good evening, Karen. Great to have you with us.
Thanks, Emma.
So it's out tomorrow, but do we have any clue about what might be in this budget?
I think the budget is about trying to save money, trying to stabilise the economy and keep inflation down, because inflation here in Australia, like around the world, is going crazy and people are under enormous pressure. So I think the government is trying to not shock people, not scare people, and just really try and sort of rein in some spending and get things under control. They've got a number of big policy areas that have huge spending, defence being one, health, aged care, and the National Disability Insurance Scheme. And they really need to start to engage in structural reform of the economy. But for this, at this stage, I think this is their first attempt. They're going to be just trying to, keep costs down as much as possible. And it's a bit of a cruel and unusual punishment, Emma. We're having our second budget in 12 months, in fact, in 6 months. Normally you have one budget a year. The previous government handed one down just before it went to the election, and that had not even passed the parliament in terms of legislation. And this is the new government now putting their stamp on things.
Everybody is facing the same challenges: slowing economic growth, consistent pressure with the cost of living. What state of health is the Australian economy in to face this?
Well, Emma, I think relatively speaking, compared with other countries, it's not doing too badly. There is, an enormous debt to pay as a result of all the payments that the government made during the COVID pandemic, where they were subsidising people's wages effectively while people stayed at home. So that needs to be serviced. But unemployment is low. And if they can address the inflation problem and encourage people to come back to Australia as migrants to fill some of those job vacancies, then they are confident that they will avoid Australia going into a recession. That's something that other countries may not avoid, but they're hoping that that can be the case here.
There's all eyes are now on the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. He has said that, in Australia, the grown-ups are in charge, as in a veiled dig at the United Kingdom's political messes. But how much is he being seen as a grown-up, and how much is he in charge?
Well, I think that's also a reference to the previous government that he considers took decisions that were not necessarily in the national interest. The new government are very critical of the previous government's spending priorities, because there were a lot of grants handed out in a very political manner, pork barreling effectively, billions of dollars handed out prior to federal elections to assist in their re-election quest. Now, a number of those are going to be unwound in this budget tomorrow. The government is proposing to save billions of dollars by reversing some of those grants. So I think that's one of the points that they're making. And obviously, he is also looking across at the UK and at the political debacle that's amazed everybody, I think, over there. But here they are trying to just stabilise. We've all been through this period of incredible unrest and stress, and I think people want confidence in government. They want to be able to trust the government, and that's one of the objectives that this new government has, to restore trust and confidence of the Australian people in their government. And part of that is sticking to the promises that were made, and we know that politicians are famous for making promises at election times and then breaking them, and this government and the Prime Minister Albanese are determined not to break those promises, because they say they need to rebuild that faith and trust. And that will then provide the goodwill they hope in the future to be able to take some of the tougher decisions that need to be taken. But at this stage, it's a very much a confidence building exercise.
And in addition to the faith and trust that needs to be rebuilt by the Australian people themselves, what about whether this budget can actually send any international message to the region?
Well, that's a very interesting and good point too. There's a great deal of concern in Australia looking around, particularly in the Pacific region, at the role and influence of China. And certainly the new government has been working very hard to build or rebuild ties with Pacific neighbours, which had really fallen away a little bit. And that's seen to have contributed to China's rising influence. So I think there'll be the region will be looking to see what money comes in behind the rhetorical commitments to the Pacific, both in defence spending, but in aid and other forms of assistance to really boost relations around that Pacific region and try to counter the role that China is playing in a security sense, which is causing some concern.
Karen Middleton in Canberra, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Briefing. Finally, a roundup of news from the Balkans. Monocle's man in the region, Guy Delaunay, is the man with the plan. Hello, Guy.
Hello, Emma. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. You all right?
Yes, sun is shining in Ljubljana, so I can't be happier.
Life is always good if the sun is shining in Ljubljana, I find.
Oh, yes.
Tell us what's happening in the world where you are, apart from good sun.
Well, in Slovenia, we are halfway, and this is going to be contested, of course, but we're halfway to getting our first female president. That's after the first round of presidential elections, which were held yesterday. Seven candidates went in, only two came out, because there's got to be a second round if nobody gets more than 50%. And those two were Anže Logar, who was the foreign minister until earlier this year when his government got hoofed out. And in second place, Nataša Pirc-Mucar, who has a very interesting history. She's been a TV news anchor, a journalist, a lawyer, and of course, most headline-grabbingly, she was Melania Trump's lawyer after Melania Trump became the First Lady of the United States.
And what is the likelihood of either of these women actually getting to the top spot?
Right, well, one of them isn't a woman, so Anže Logar, very much male. So Nataša Pirc-Mucar came in second place. She was 7 percentage points behind Logar. So he got 34%, she got 27%. Her chances of making the next round have been improved by the fact that the governing party, the Freedom Movement, now is putting its weight behind her. She's an independent candidate, but quite a lot of political parties have come out and said they supported her. The Freedom Movement hadn't been one of those, but its candidate didn't make it into the final two, so it's now weighing in behind her. So we're now going to have an interesting couple of weeks of campaigning with Logar and Pirc-Mucar setting out their respective stalls. She's saying very much she's going to be independent and outspoken. He, on the other hand, is a remnant of the right-wing SDS government that we had for a couple of years here in Slovenia, which a lot of people didn't enjoy. So it's quite interesting to see that he's done so well in the presidential poll.
Who is the person that they wish to replace?
This would be Borut Pahor. I would say your friend and mine, Emma, because we featured him in Monocle magazine. He was known as the Instagram president because of his mastery of social media. And he served two terms in Slovenia as the president and was regularly ranked as the most popular politician in the country. People liked what he did on social media. They liked the fact that he represented the whole country. And the fact that he was a former male model also meant that he knew how to pose.
Excellent. Let's move on to Slovenia's issues when it comes to I hate the expression, but the brain drain. What effect is it having on the economy and society?
It's particularly having one in small towns and cities across Slovenia. And there's an association of historic towns in Slovenia, and they're calling on the government to do something about the fact that more and more of these small towns are emptying out. They're being hollowed out. The talented young people are leaving, whether that's to cities like Ljubljana or Maribor, or whether it's going to other places in the European Union, Austria, Italy, Germany. That's by the by. They're saying there's a massive problem with these old city centres. About two-thirds of the residents of old city centres are more than 65 years old, and as many as 4 in 10 of the buildings in city centres are empty, at least partly, if not completely. So they're asking the state to step in, buy up buildings, refurbish them, and rent them out at attractive rates to young families.
What is the likelihood of the government stepping in and saying, yes, they'll help? Because usually when it comes to this kind of situation, there has to be a direct appeal to people outside the country to come in and actually revivify it with private money.
Yeah, it's possibly higher than it was, because we have the opposite problem in Ljubljana, where we have a housing shortage and very high prices, which young people find it very hard to afford. So one of the things which this new government, led by the Freedom Movement, needs to do is to sort out the housing crisis in Slovenia. It needs to solve it particularly for young people. I mean, another statistic I could throw at you is two-thirds of people aged between 18 and 34 still live with their parents. Now, that's unsustainable. So there is a potential win-win here. If you make these historic towns attractive to young people somehow, especially with things like remote working now making that more of a possibility, then perhaps there will be a win out of this, and the state, which has shown so far under the new government that it is open to intervening in the housing situation here, if they can do that, then maybe this will be a win-win situation.
There is a huge opportunity to be had. Finally, let's go and perch in Eurovision Corner. We're big fans of that here. Bring us the latest from your neck of the woods when it comes to Eurovision.
North Macedonia and Montenegro won't be there, Emma. Terribly sad. Although it has to be said, they didn't make the final last year. Serbia came fifth in the final last year under previous winners. Montenegro and North Macedonia, though, are saying it's too expensive to go to Liverpool, which is a bit of a shock for somebody who is a native of Liverpool like myself. And I can tell you, I've had many very good nights out in Liverpool on very little money, but North Macedonia and Montenegro are saying with the current energy crisis, the extra bills they're going to have to pay to Eurovision because of Russia's absence, they simply can't justify the expense of going over and quite possibly getting knocked out in the semi-finals again.
I was going to say, have North Macedonia and Montenegro not been made aware of your existence? Because you could sort them out.
I could, of course. And do you know what? There'd be loads of people in Liverpool who'd be very, very happy to sort them out. There's been the usual price gouging on Airbnb and hotel websites, of course. But I think there's plenty of, salt-of-the-earth Liverpudlians who would be nothing short of delighted to host delegations from other countries. So, yes, they should reach out.
Seriously, I see a rescue mission on the cards here. Finally, let's head to Croatia, where it is expensive to go out. In fact, it's even more expensive if you want to go out and stay warm.
So you will have seen, Emma, in lots of parts of the European continent, the heaters that we have outside cafes and bars in the winter so people can, frankly, smoke outside rather than sit inside where they can't smoke. This is, I think, the main motivation of it, though I like them myself because I prefer sitting outside and I don't smoke. But it's going to be more expensive in Zagreb. One cafe has started saying, if you sit at a heated table, we're going to charge you more for your coffee. The coffee actually says, now it says coffee with heater. And the coffee with heater is more. And the Caterers Association says this is going to catch on because electricity and gas costs have gone up and we need those things to heat our patios. So you're out of luck if you want to sit outside, or at least you'll be out of pocket.
I can see everybody cramming round one single table.
Exactly. That'll be the strategy.
Guy Delaunay, thank you so much for joining us on the line. That's all we have time for today's edition of The Briefing. Many thanks to all my guests and to the producer, Rhys James, our researcher, Emily Sands, and our studio manager, Callum McLean. The Briefing is back tomorrow, but the Monocle Daily team's here later today to go through the day's biggest stories. That'll be at 1800 London time. We will probably have a new Prime Minister by then. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for listening and have a great week.